It's been the best part of 8 years since Joe Cornish released his directorial debut, Attack the Block, and in, well, my humble opinion, his follow-up, The Kid Who Would Be King, has been well worth the wait. That's not to say Joe hasn't been busy co-writing The Adventures of Tintin with Edgar Wright, Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, and Ant-Man with Edgar and Paul Rudd, amongst others. But it's great to have him back at the helm. Now, based on an idea that Joe originally had as a 12-year-old, The Kid Who Would Be King tells the story of a young boy who finds King Arthur's legendary sword, Excalibur, and must then use it to stop the mythical enchantress Morgana from destroying the world. Now, during our chat, you'll hear us forgetting a lot of things. A woman singing in Joe's bath, music by Prefab Sprout, Led Zeppelin and John Williams, and the quite wonderfully over-the-top trailer for John Boorman's Excalibur. The Kid Who Would Be King is scored by Electric Wave Bureau, a collective comprising Damon Albarn, his wife Susie Winstanley, Michael Smith and Nelson De Freitas, and it's with their cue, Enter Merlin, that we begin. Cornish, welcome to Soundtracking.
Thanks for having me.
Do you know one of the things I really wanted to ask you, because I know how much of a film fan you are,
yes,
and have been since a young age,
yeah,
how exciting it was for you to have your new film have the 20th Century Fox trumpets.
Amazing,
at,
yeah,
the start.
It's fantastic.
That's something that, you know, as a kid you're like, you know, that kind of...
Yeah. No, we did have it played by... with medieval instruments.
Yeah.
We thought it'd be cool to have a medieval version, but it just sounded like an episode of Blackadder. So we thought, nah, let's just have the real thing. Plus we thought, no, the real thing sounds like a proper film. If you swap it out with little tinkly, like, hooters, it doesn't...
Kazoos.
Kazoos, yeah, it doesn't sound so good. But then, I mean, yeah, no, it's such an iconic logo and piece of music that it elevates everything you stick it in front of.
Yeah, it is. It's like, but it's really transformative as well, in terms of you suddenly have almost kind of that, you know, like when people say, like, when you're about to die your life flashes in front of you, when you hear that you almost have this kind of fast cut of all the films or some of the films that you've,
yeah,
seen in that environment with that,
yeah,
playing sort of thing.
I mean, 20th Century Fox, as everybody knows, are being absorbed by Disney.
Yeah.
At the time of recording this, nobody quite knows what's going to happen to it. It feels like it's going to survive as a brand within,
yeah,
Disney at the moment. But one of the things that makes me feel it'll never die is who in their right mind would get rid of that,
yeah,
logo and that piece of music?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it would be like sort of stamping on a one of the, what are they called, the ravens at the Tower of London or something, wouldn't,
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, or a swan in Regent's Park.
Exactly. It would be so transgressive to be the person responsible for snuffing out that flame.
Yeah.
That, you know, in and of itself, it might keep that studio alive. I hope it does.
Congratulations on The Kid Who Would Be King.
Thank
it's
you.
It's brilliant. I was lucky enough to chat to quite a lot of the cast at the weekend, including Sir Patrick Stewart, who plays your older Merlin. And I've got to mention young Mr. Imrie as well. Oh my God,
he's
amazing.
Great, isn't he? Yeah.
I mean, I must have seen him in something
before. He's in
before.
The Archers.
Oh.
You wouldn't have seen him in The Archers, only in your
in my
mind's
mind.
Eye. Yeah. He's made another independent movie, well, an independent movie called Pond Life, that I think he shot just before The Kid Who Would Be King, that hasn't been released yet.
Okay.
But no, he is a very, very excellent actor.
Oh my God, I can't wait to
and
see
him. And he's going places, yeah.
Because
he's very charismatic and brilliant. And
yeah.
I actually wrote that part younger. I envisaged it as a younger Merlin who was the same age as the youngest as kids Alex, in the cast. Yeah. But then the casting director said we were struggling to find a young kid that had the right charisma and yeah. chops. And the casting director, Jessica Renane, said, oh, it's such a shame the character isn't a little bit older because there's this actor called Angus Imrie and he's so good. You sure you don't want to see him? I said, all right, then bring him in. And just the second he started performing, it was like, right, that's it. He looks 16, we'll be fine. Age up the character a few years, done.
Is that an easy thing to do?
Age up a character? Yeah, there's a key on Final Draft. Just go Control A, hold down A and U, age up. And it just ages everybody
instantly.
Up. Well, instantly, yeah. Screenwriting's very easy. It's mostly software-based these
Most
days.
Most commands.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you start thinking about the music with the film? Because it's you have to tell me about the Electric Wave Bureau, because I don't know that much about them, apart from the brilliant work you did on Paddington 1 and 2.
Yes. So, I always think it sounds a bit like the British Electric Foundation. Do you remember that?
Or like or ELO's, like, sort
yeah,
of children.
Yeah, yeah. British Electric Foundation was Heaven 17, wasn't it? It was like,
was it?
It was some weird logo on the Heaven 17 albums. But what it is that while I was writing and also while we were doing the costume tests, we would play Dirty Harry by Gorillaz a lot. Because that track has sort of swagger, it's very cinematic, it's got an orchestral element, it's also got this chorus of kids in it,
yeah.
And it sort of summed up the tone that we wanted to capture with the film. We thought about Damon Auburn, and then it turned out that Damon has this film composing collective with his wife Susie Winstanley. She's an autonomous individual in her own right. You shouldn't describe her just as the man's wife. That's sexist, isn't it? So Damon Auburn, Susie Winstanley, Mike Smith, who's also the musical director for Gorillaz and The Good, the Bad and the Queen, and Nelson De Freitas, and they are Electric Wave Bureau. Pretty cool. He's very, and this is something I respect him for, he doesn't want to be seen as the main person because it's very much a collective and a collaborative affair. But he is a riff factory. He really is. He sort of sits there like a noodle machine and creates these amazing little melodies. And he also has this kind of archive of, you know, offcuts or album tracks that never ended up on an album. So as a group, they can go into this library of material.
Oh, wow.
So some of it was found riffs and some of it was stuff specially composed. then they all cluster around and shape it and choose it and cut it. And then obviously there's, you know, an orchestrator comes on board, and then the music editor composes stuff based around their riffs. It's a big collaborative process. For me, it's all about melodies, because I love a movie with a melody. You know, it's not a brilliantly original thing to say, but I remember the movies of my childhood having hummable themes. And that's what I want. And, you know, Basement Jack's in Attack the Block, and EWB in this movie, they're both collaborations between orchestral composers and pop musicians, because the pop musicians know how to write 5 or 6 note licks that yeah. are real earworms.
Work out of Damon's studio in West London.
They do.
Because I've been there, and
so have I.
He spent about 2 hours taking me through an old sound system that he'd got off an ice cream machine.
Yeah.
And sort of was so proud wow. of this new piece of kit that he'd just got off an ice cream
well,
machine.
Well, that's a big part of the history of pop music in general, isn't it? Finding new sounds.
Yeah. Or old things you can put your new
Yeah.
visions or melodies or things through to
just
give
collecting,
them a, yeah,
collecting
stuff.
Technology. Yeah, I just read a book about the early history of Prefab Sprout.
Oh, wow.
It's a really good book. I recommend it. And that talks about how some of the effects on their single When Love Breaks Down are the first time a particular vocal processor was used by Thomas Dolby, I think, or
yeah.
someone like that. So it's amazing how much that matters.
Together, but often we're apart. Absence makes the heart lose weight, yeah. Till love breaks down, love breaks down.
Nice as well that we're chatting on the birthday of John Williams.
Is it the birthday of John Williams?
It is the birthday of John Williams
wow.
today, which is kind of nice. So I was listening to E.T. on the way up on the plane.
What a soundtrack.
Yeah, just talking about melody. That was
yeah.
when you said, you know, you love melody. And weirdly, that was kind of, I was like, oh, I want to talk about John Williams. And that
yes.
was the first one that popped in. Not Star Wars, weirdly, which I would
no.
have thought would have been the first one that came to my head. But
those are obviously the most indelible themes, certainly mm. for my generation. Superman, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars,
yeah.
E.T., themes you're humming as soon as you walk out of the cinema. Yeah. In E.T. particularly, there's a track called Toys
yeah.
that plays when Elliot is showing E.T. his toys, the Star Wars figures. And sometimes what's interesting about musical cues is they accompany one particular narrative strand. So that cue is really about E.T. and him looking at this boy who's explaining his society in this very naive way. But here's this ancient, old, wise alien watching the boy. And there's a little bit of pity in the music
yeah.
and sort of naivety and innocence. And it's incredibly moving because it's, for me anyway, because it just brings out something incredibly earnest and yearning in the scene. It's very, very beautiful. Also in Williams soundtracks, you have those amazing moments of apotheosis, right? When everything in the story converges. So when Indiana Jones rises up on, you think he's dead, but then he climbs onto the back of the submarine and pumps his fist. When the bicycle's flying, yeah. E.T., you know, when all the sort of narrative strands that the director and writer have set up converge and sort of meet at this perfect moment, and his theme kicks in, almost like an engine starting up. And it's not even blasting, it's like your favourite steam train is starting up. And it's
running alongside
you. And you're like, oh, yes. It's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, the ending of E.T. in particular is a symphony. I mean, there's very, very minimal dialogue for the last seven minutes of that movie. And try watching it with the sound down, and it ain't very cutty.
And it's almost like a short film love story, I think, as well. Almost kind of like a, almost like a silent movie, 6 minute silent movie, almost of a love story. These kind of two.
The bit I don't like is when Wish Upon a Star comes in. Oh no, that's Close Encounters, isn't it? That's the end of Close Encounters. Yeah, I don't like that bit. It doesn't need it.
What was it like working with Spielberg, though? I mean, you know, considering that this is someone that you've, you know, I'm not sure I'd be able to actually see anything to his face.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You're so used to seeing, if people that famous, you're so used to just being watching them passively. Yeah. That actually making your body, making your face speak, and you're just like, go on, carry on talking. I'm looking at you, you're off the telly. I've got what you can see me, and you can hear what I'm saying. So it's a bit like that for a bit, but really you're in, you know, well, okay, so the first meeting was in a place called Giant Studios in Santa Monica, and Edgar and I had been brought it in to rewrite Stephen Moffat's screenplay because it was a bit too long and Moffat was leaving to be the showrunner on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So I was asked by Edgar if I wanted to work on it. I said, yes. I bought an economy ticket to Los Angeles. I sat, I'm very tall, so I was very cramped in this seat on Virgin Atlantic, and I reread all the Tintin books, so I was completely up to speed.
Didn't watch any films?
No, I was just Tintin studying on the plane over. And then I eventually walked into this meeting room with Peter Jackson, Steven Spielberg, Edgar and me, and a couple of the producers.
Jesus.
And I didn't say much. They were talking about the script, and Edgar suddenly said, Joe's got an idea of how to compress the story. Joe, tell him your idea. And it was like, da, da, da. And so I pitched this idea, and the idea was to actually combine the original screenplay had two villains, Saccharin and Rackham.
Yeah.
So the pirate and the collector. And my idea was to make them descendants and to cast the same actor. By doing that, you could compress a bunch of the exposition. And I remember Peter Jackson going, yeah, that's quite good. That's quite a good idea. That's a New Zealand accent I was doing there. And I was like, oh, my God. And then that was it, really. And then you just have to kind of get on with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, every day I assumed I would be fired. I mean, I was just waiting for someone to go, oh, Joe, you're not really – you're a radio presenter, and I'm not sure you should be here. So – it's been great, but bye-bye. But that never happened.
Right through to the end.
Well, yeah, right through to the second week of filming.
Okay.
And then, because I have to say that I was a small cog in a massive machine, you know. I was one of quite a few writers on that film. Spielberg contributed, Peter Jackson contributed, Fran Walsh contributed, yeah. Edgar contributed massively, Moffat contributed massively. You know, it's a huge collaborative. But there's some stuff of mine in there, bits and bobs,
yeah,
you know, which is pretty cool.
Amazing. Have you got a lady singing in your bath?
I like to. That's the.
Lady in the bath.
That's the lady in the bath. It's like the lady in the water.
She's going to come out with a sword and like in your film.
It's the Shape of Water. I've got a fish girlfriend in there.
With a sword.
Yeah, with a sword. It's kinky.
Can't hear it, can you? You can hear her, can't you? Or is it just me?
No, I can hear her. Okay. It's my fish girlfriend. We've established this. You can't now expect her to go away now that we've summoned her.
Do you listen to music when you're writing?
Yes, I do.
Do you create playlists?
No, I tend to just listen to an album.
Okay.
And weirdly, I like to go a little bit ambient. So I listen to the remake of Solaris, the Soderbergh Solaris soundtrack. Who's that by? A man.
Oh, man.
I've got it on my laptop.
Yeah.
Cliff Martinez.
Oh, Cliff Martin, of course it is.
Thank you.
So I listened a lot to the Solaris soundtrack by Cliff Martinez, which is very kind of backgroundy and ambient. Because if it's something too arresting, it'll stop my brain from thinking. I'll just start thinking about Indiana Jones or something like that.
Having E.T. in your brain.
Yeah.
That, right.
So the other one I listened to a lot was Knight of Cups.
Okay.
Not a film.
Yeah.
I'm crazy about. I don't dislike it.
I've never seen it.
One of my number ones.
Okay.
Rooney Mara and Tom Hiddleston, is it? No.
That's
not Tom Hiddleston, it's the other bloke. What's he called?
I've not.
Fred Bassett. What's he called? The big star.
Fred Bassett?
Yeah.
Licorice all
I
sorts.
Anyway, Knight of Cups, just again because it's quite sort of ambient.
Okay.
It's really sort of to block out other thoughts more than to actually inspire stuff. But if I'm writing an action sequence, I might put on a bit of John Williams or something more thrusting and powerful.
And do you have music around on set?
Pretty much 100% no, but we did on one occasion in The Kid Who Would Be King when the characters go to the school and Alex gives his big rousing speech attempting to make all the kids fall in line. We played that track from the Kenneth Branagh Henry V film. What's it called? St. Trinian's Day? Not St. Trinian's. You know,
yes.
St. Patrick's Day or whatever it's called. I don't know what it's called. I don't know anything.
Memory's gone today.
You know the one, though. The super rousing one that's basically encoded into British people's brains and makes them fight the Europeans if you play it. We played that and everybody really loved it.
Did you speak to any of your cast about whether they used music to like help with character and that kind of thing? Because I can't remember who I'd been speaking to was talking about how they had a song that they would play just in their headphones before they went on set. And I was like, God, I wonder if everybody does that, you know, in terms of like pump them up and a bit of a kind of like going into the ring type thing.
We played, as well as Gorillaz, for Angus, for Merlin, we played No Quarter by Led Zeppelin.
Nice.
A lot, which has some Arthurian references in it. So his costume tests was him dancing around to that Led Zepp track.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, I love that track.
Close the door, put out the light. No, they won't be home tonight. The snow falls hard and don't you know? Winds of Thor are blowing cold. They're wearing steel that's bright and true.
The original Excalibur had a pretty lasting effect on you, and you sort of said that you obviously saw it before you should have done. Mm. I think we've all done that. Mm. Mine's was The Deer Hunter. Oof. Which is like pretty brutal.
Yeah, well, this was the golden era when there was no certification on VHS, so there's a whole generation of us that were, I think, in a positive way, exposed prematurely to all these.
The Hitcher as well, I remember.
Oh, I saw with that the at chip. The cinema, The Hitcher.
The ketchup, and yeah. Not being a chip.
And he's pulled in two by the two cars. Oh, good movie. But, like, if you were around in the late 70s, early 80s, you could hire anything you wanted. For a window of about 4 years before the video nasty moral panic happened and certification arrived. So, you know, when I was 12, one night I went to my friend Jolyon Parsons' house and we rented The Zombie Flesh Eaters, The Exorcist and Fame.
And we Who were,
we were 12. Well, Fame was the most traumatizing of the three because of that bit at the beginning when he's pretending to take a shit. Do you remember that? I thought, this is outrageous. I don't mind the woman's eyeball being penetrated by the splinter or the possessed girl, but this man pretending to have a poo is beyond the pale.
Someone bring in some certification.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was in that period I saw Excalibur as well, and it's quite erotic and very violent and pretty esoteric and weirdly sort of brilliantly over the top. Mm-hmm. Like incredible performance by Nicole Williamson as Merlin. The photography is extraordinary. The use of landscape is amazing. The whole thing's amazing. And not to overuse the word amazing, but I was amazed as a kid by it.
A wizard's ancient spell.
Into the eyes of the dragon and in despair.
And the lust of a lord.
I must have her. One night with her.
Give birth to an empire.
Behold the sword of power, Excalibur!
The future has taken root in the present. It is done.
One land, one king!
Orion Pictures presents John Boorman's Excalibur.
Knights of the Round Table, we shall always come together in a circle to hear and tell of deeds good and brave. And I will marry.
Don't you know me, Merlin? Because I'm a creature like you.
Their magic is Merlin.
Are you just a dream to some?
A nightmare to others.
Their king is Arthur.
You are my husband.
I must be king first.
Their power is Excalibur.
I swear eternal faith to our king.
Sir Lancelot, you will be my champion.
What is that? Greatest quality of knighthood.
Truth.
We're high devil then.
Where you never expected.
I protest my innocence!
Were I not king, I would make you pay with your life!
A world of wizards, kings, warriors, queens, swords, sorcery, and desire. Forged of splendor and magic, where future meets past, flesh meets steel, and the only fear is the pain of love. Excalibur, sword of power, sword of kings.
I mean, John Boorman, Deliverance is really the only other thing that I really know in depth that he's done.
Mm-hmm. Leo the Lost, from Hope and Glory.
There we go, of course, yeah.
Hope and Glory was good.
Yeah, Hope and Glory's great.
You bold a googly.
Trevor Jones, the composer that he worked with on Excalibur, and I was just looking at all the stuff that he'd done. Mm. Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Angel Heart, Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
Great film.
Hello. Yes, this is Harold Angel. Well, yeah, I could be free.
Thank you. to introduce my client, Monsieur Louis Sackler.
Hiya, Harry Angel.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Angel.
And then things like Cliffhanger and In the Name of the Father. It's like...
A couple of classics.
But what an amazing...
In the Name of the Father.
Daniel Day-Lewis, man. Have you ever met him?
No. Have you?
No, but I've heard... I was chatting to Thelma Schoonmaker today, and she was talking about him in Gangs of New York, and how he stayed as in character as Bill the Butcher for the entire shoot, even like if they'd go out for dinner at night.
Really? That must be quite tiring, don't you think?
Yeah.
Come on, Daniel, just for 5 minutes, can't you snap out of it?
I was thinking about the guy having a poop now.
Yeah. Snap out of it, Leroy. That's the character's name, not the actor's name.
What other films going into making The Kid Who Would Be King? Do you watch stuff before you start filming? Not as kind of a inspiration or anything, but just, I don't know, as kind of...
Not so much this one, you know, because it was so ingrained in me. Because I thought of it when I was 12, and I pictured all the first act and the last act I pretty much had by the time I was 13.
Wow.
And I didn't know it didn't make sense, really, but I had a whole string of bits. And that sounds like a character from a Predator movie who has a string of bits. I carry all the bits on a string around my neck. I was really writing from sort of my little child brain, really. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, hopefully applying my wise adult screenwriting experience brain to it as well. Yeah, but not really. I mean...
But I think that's a good thing. That's almost what you want, isn't it? Because you are... It's kind of from a... It's a child's perspective of this kind of story, the child's experience, so...
We talked about, when I first talked to Bill Pope, we talked about Kes.
Yeah.
And we talked about wanting it to be naturalistic, because we felt it would, the fantasy would be more effective if it existed in a sort of realistic world. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Attack the Block, we looked at The Warriors and Streets of Fire, Assault and Precinct 13, because that was about lighting at night. And we purposely wanted to make Attack the Block look like a 70s Disney movie. We wanted to do the precise opposite of what everyone else had done with gritty British urban films.
Yeah.
And make it colourful and escapist and phantasmagorical and psychedelic, but limit ourselves to using real things that you would find in the environment. So the green of a traffic light and the exhaust of a car would create a magical, ethereal puff of green smoke, you know. Mm-hmm. The uplights on the tower block would make it look like the engines of a spaceship. So anything we could find that turned the...
Even when you see them walking in the tower block for the first time and the kind of angles of that kind of entrance.
Yeah, to make it look like a spaceship.
Yeah.
But this one, it was really, I think, more to make it feel like recognisable suburban reality, I suppose, and make it feel as realistic as possible.
Yeah,
so this was less informed by references.
When was the last time you watched Attack the Block?
Well, I watched it for the first time all the way through about... 6 months ago.
The first time?
Yeah. I watched it. They showed it at the BFI IMAX, and I watched a good half an hour of it there because it looked amazing on that big screen. But there comes a moment when I really wish I'd done better, and I just go, oof. But I think a lot of directors are like that.
Well, yeah, they must be. Well, I watched it again. I haven't watched it since kind of came out, so I think I'm desperate to show Rudy, my 10-year-old, it actually. Oh, man, it was great fun watching it again. So good.
Oh, good.
And the music in it as well, you know, it's just really cleverly thought out. And I know you did a lot of research in terms of speaking and spending time with kids that age in that sort of neighbourhood, trying to kind of really make it feel authentic and real.
We did, yes. The first thing I figured out the story and then got an artist friend to draw 5 or 6 moments from it, cartoon style, a couple of experimental images of the alien, kids on the mopeds, the aliens climbing up the outside of the block. So like 5 or 6 key images. And then with this brilliant writer and researcher called Lucy Pardy, we went to a bunch of youth clubs, youth groups, trying to find kids that were like the characters and talking them through the story and just literally showing them an image. We used a lot of photography by a photographer called Charlie White, mm-hmm. who does these amazing pictures where he makes alien carcasses and puts them in a sort of sort of inner city environment, but in, you know, South America or somewhere like that. So there'll be this chubby kid with an alien carcass on a stick. I recorded all the responses. I recorded everything the young people said, and then I went home and transposed it, and I ended up with two massive fat A4 files full of transcripts. And then I went through with a highlighter pen and I just highlight the funniest bits. So there's a lot of it just went straight into the script, too much madness for one text. And then by just the process of transposing it and listening to it, I sort of taught myself so I could start to write little bits for myself. Because the other excuse was it was like a science fiction language, like whatever the language in Clockwork Orange is called. Nadzak or something. Nutsack, I want to say, but it's not called that. Yeah. Or Klingon, Nasdaq. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it an easy thing when you're choosing existing music to put in a film? So like songs that people have a connection with already, so...
I'm not a big fan of that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in my work, mm-hmm. I don't mind it in other people's. I think, for instance, when Edgar does it, it's so incredibly cleverly done.
I mean, Baby Driver, Jesus.
Yeah, and that's a proper thought experiment in diegetic and non-diegetic music. Yeah. But me and Adam used to really dislike it, weirdly, on BBC documentaries. We always just think, fucking hell, the BBC have got this agreement with the music publishing companies where they can use anything, right? So they'll use like 20 seconds of a Beatles song on Holmes Under the Hammer. And you're like, and yes, it's fun and exciting. But it's like, yeah, but that's the Beatles. Like, come on, do a bit of work. Don't just...
Yeah.
And we always used to be very cynical about how people relied on needle drops.
Yeah, like X Factor and those shows when it's a sob story.
But you see it in movies as well, like the story's flagging, so Tears for Fears kicks in really loud for 15 seconds and it just sometimes feels a bit lazy. Like you should be doing that with your storytelling and your filmmaking, not just it's a bit of a rant. Anyway, before when me and Adam used to find that, we used to be very sarcastic about it when we saw it, and that sarcastic attitude has slightly stayed with me, as you can tell.
Yeah.
And plus, the movies I love don't really do that. That's really a mid-90s thing. Wasn't happening so much in 80s movies, was it? There'd be a hit single at the end, like Cindy Lauper would sing
good enough.
Goonies Are Good Enough at the end.
Yeah.
There might be in Ghostbusters, a robot might come into the room, or someone might walk through a scene with a Walkman on, and you'd briefly hear a bit of a track.
Back to the Future was the first one, so it had the Johnny B. Goode in it where he's playing.
But it's still, they're all seeded into the storytelling, I think. Ghostbusters Power definitely had a few, because the Ghostbusters soundtrack had Do You Believe in Magic?
Yeah.
It had 7 or 8 tracks. And I remember trying to find them in the movie. I didn't hear that in the film. And it literally was Bill Murray or like a janitor walking past with a Walkman on.
Yeah.
And that would be their excuse to put it on the soundtrack. Yeah.
Tarantino started a whole new...
Yes, I guess, but at least he was being a sort of vinyl junkie, wasn't he? He was bringing back...
It was part of his storytelling, really, in the way that he did it.
He does it very cleverly, but it can be done lazily. So generally, I don't think there's any in... Is there any in The Kid Who Would Be King?
I can't think of the... I mean, I made...
Oh, there's some Bucks Fizz.
Oh, my God, there is.
There's
Land of
Make-Believe
by Bucks
Fizz. Stars in your
little one, where do you go to dream? To a place we all know, the land of make-believe.
Oh
man.
See, that the terrible honest truth is that was the album I was listening to when I thought of this idea when I was 12.
And how lovely that you got to put it in the film.
Well, that's why I put it in the film. Because
did
it's
it cost
sort
much?
Of, well, you know what? It did cost quite a bit because the people who wrote that song.
Hold
I'm
on.
I'm sorry
hold
to
on.
Shatter your
oh
dreams,
my God.
But Mike, Cheryl, Kevin, and Boris.
Was no Kevin.
Whatever they were called.
Mike, Cheryl. Oh my God.
Yeah, Mike and Cheryl is correct.
Oh my God. What were their names?
Boris.
No.
And
Mickey. Come on. Jay. Jay was the other lady.
That's right.
And the other guy
Mike,
was...
Cheryl, Jay.
And
Pat Shop.
You're thinking of the TV game show with the twins, aren't you?
Oh, the twins. Yeah. The TV game show, Funhouse.
Funhouse, yeah.
We're not going to struggle to
man,
remember
what
that.
Is his name? I know they
anyway,
were,
listen, while you're looking for this, the actual songwriters, sorry to shatter your illusions,
God.
Are pretty well-known, thrusting. No, they're pretty important, good, strong songwriters who've won Ivor Novello Awards and stuff like that. And
Bobby G. How could
Bobby
you not
G.
remember Bobby G?
Why are you asking me that? How could you not remember
I wasn't,
Bobby G?
Sorry, did I say that? I was asking myself.
Yeah, so it's not cheap to clear Bucks Fizz, but boy, is it worth it.
Man.
Yeah, plus Land of Make-Believe, it suits the story nicely, I think. It ain't cool, but I like that. I like going the other way.
People won't know what it is. That's
most people
thing.
Won't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think parents will know.
Yeah, but the kids won't.
The kids won't, but little do they know I'm planting subconsciously the evil seed of Bucks Fizz in their brains.
It's like on the...
it's like the Manchurian Candidate, but with twirling and bobby socks.
And Velcro skirts.
Yeah.
I've said to a few people actually at the weekend when I was talking to them with some of the cast, it's like, I really hope that this film for a certain generation of kids is the first, well, for me, you know, I remember watching all those films like E.T. and stuff that we mentioned, and Indiana Jones, one of the first films I remember getting to go to the cinema on my own with my mates to watch without parents. And that was a big thing. And I hope that this does the same thing. I think it will for a certain generation of film fans who this might be the first film they see at the cinema. Because it's got that real heart to it, I think, that those films had as well.
I hope so. That's nice of you to say. That's very much the ambition. It's tough out there. You know, there's a lot of toy-based movies tempting kids in. There's a lot of big stars dressed in tights, punching each other.
But what they do, I think, that is a real shame for... Like, I've got a 10-year-old, but we can't. He can't go to the cinema and watch any of those films. We can watch them at home because I'm a bad parent and I let him watch them. Do you know what I mean? But there's a kind of weird sort of age gap, 10 to 14, really, where they can't go to the cinema and watch these films. And there's something magical about going to the cinema and that experience. And this, I think, is one of those things where you can't, and it's like, whoa.
I hope so. I think certainly my generation had the privilege of being able to go and see films starring kids.
Yeah.
When you were a kid,
yeah.
Especially live action.
Yeah, exactly.
Like The Black Stallion was very big for me. E.T. was very big for me.
Goonies was big for me.
Yeah, and they're movies with recognisable characters in a recognisable world.
Well, you could easily be one of them.
Yeah, and the fantasy arrives in the real world, and that's very powerful when you're that age. So yeah, that's definitely what we're trying to do with The Kid Who Would Be King.
You've had the story with you for a long time. Why was kind of now the time, and why was this the film that you wanted to make following on from Attack the Block?
It was sort of, I think, a result of slowly realising I could get the finance to make something bigger after Attack the Block. I didn't know what Attack the Block was going to end up like.
I
didn't know what
morning.
The response was going to be. You know, it's kind of a weird film for me as half of Adam and Joe to make, you know. I really didn't know what the response was going to be. So it took me a while to realise that people liked it. Also, the response was quite mixed at first. You know, it didn't set the box office alight. A lot of maybe slightly more right-wing people thought it was outrageous that I was sort of turning this mugger into a hero. A lot of people didn't like the young actors. Actually, quite a lot of the criticism of Attack the Block is similar to some of the criticism that The Kid Who Would Be King is getting. But, you know, that always happens with a movie in the first flourish of its arrival in the world. And then people who it doesn't work for just drift off. And you're left with the people who do like it. And, you know, the fate of the film depends on how many people there are after that opening weekend. And luckily Attack the Block has worked for lots of people. So it took me a while to realise that it was okay, you know, and people liked it. And then I got offered approached about a bunch of big Hollywood films, but felt too trepidatious and inexperienced to take on a massive project. Thought I might get crushed by the wheels of industry in another Heaven 17 reference, second one of the podcast. And then I thought, okay, well, if I do have an opportunity to do something on a larger scale, why not do something of my own?
Yeah.
And seeing as this whole event in my life felt like a flipping dream come true anyway, you know, working for Marvel, working for Spielberg, Attack the Block, getting the notices it did, well, why not actually do a genuine bit of wish fulfillment, which was this story I thought of when I was 12.
On that journey of kind of from Attack the Block, you know, going on to work, you know, on Tintin and Ant-Man and that experience, do you think that helped with Kid Who Would Be King?
I think so, yeah. It was an education about how the industry works.
Yeah.
Like taking a bit of time out, watching my peers who did take on big films, some of them succeeding, some of them having hits that they didn't feel were theirs, some of them having tough times, you know, was interesting. It was kind of a bit of a wake-up call and, you know, it was having fantasized about it for so long to see the reality in action was interesting. To take a bunch of meetings, but then step away and see what actually happened rather than what people said would happen was instructive. In terms of the actual process of filmmaking, it's sort of the same. And everyone says this, and it's true, whether you're working with £100 or, you know, £100 million. Not that I've ever worked with £100 million.
Yet.
You never got enough time, you never got enough resources, everything always goes wrong, and it's all just a hustle, you know. But I've got a fantastic producer and amazing people around me, so it's made pretty easy for me.
What's next, do you know?
In terms of me making films?
Yeah.
I don't know. No, I've got a screenplay that I'm midway through that I'm writing with a chap called Brian Duffield and have been writing for a few years. It's a sort of, it's a film. But, you know, I just don't know, you know.
Yeah. It takes so long.
It takes so long and stuff changes so much. You know, even since I've made Attack the Block, the industry's changed so much. Mm-hmm. Like streaming and stuff and dominance of superhero movies and I don't know. So I think a short period of assessment. Mm-hmm. But I really want to try not to take so long this time.
Talking of superhero involves, you had a kind of dip into the Marvel world. Mm. What was that experience?
It was a very long dip. It was a soak.
Yeah.
A nice good 8-year soak.
Wow.
It was
something like that.
Well, Edgar first discussed Ant-Man with them after Shaun of the Dead.
Holy crap.
That was a long time ago. And then we both wrote the treatment together after Shaun of the Dead because I would tag team.
Is that film basically yours then? The story of that first film?
The story is Edgar and mine, yeah. And, you know, Edgar had the basic outline for it. He knew he wanted to be a heist. And it is based on the Tales to Astonish. It's based on elements of the original comic.
Yeah.
But a bunch of stuff in the finished film is still out. It's obviously not done in the way that Edgar would have done it. And a bunch of stuff is not ours. But it was a fascinating process, sort of witnessing the way that company evolved and changed and found its success over all those years. Mm. Was an amazing thing to be part of and to observe from inside.
Yeah.
It's a shame Edgar didn't get to make our version, but I think it was very brave and right of him to decide to step out rather than make a compromised version.
Do you think you two ever make a film together?
I think he's in charge. Here's the thing about collaborating with someone or working with another person. And weirdly, Jonathan Ross said this to me years ago, and I think it's proved to be true. You kind of got to know who's in charge. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it'll just be feuds and end in ugliness. And in a way, that was Adam and I used to struggle with that. Like, we both wanted to be in charge the whole time.
Yeah.
And eventually, we would just have to go and do our make little toy movies independently. So one of the things, quite rightly, I'm sort of working with Edgar, but he's the guy. You know, I'm there to enable and assist him, really. That makes it sound very one-sided, but and that actually isn't how it manifests itself. If you, it's very collaborative, but in my mind, he's smarter than me, I think, you know. We're very different as well. We do very different things, but especially if it's a project he's brought me onto, which was the case with Ant-Man and Tintin. I wouldn't have been there without him.
I'd love to see you both create something from the start together. You know what I mean? That kind of thing where it's not your idea or his idea. It's kind of like...
Yeah, we have noodled around with a thing, but we keep going off and doing other things.
That's a favourite word of yours as well, noodle.
Noodles. Yeah. They're delicious. And they
and also character existence. And gorillas. There you go.
There you go.
There you go. Joe, thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure.
And the minstrels that are set out in a really weird sort of...
Slightly obsessive
four
compulsive.
For me, four for you.
Yeah, away. Now you must have your minstrels.
And people, please go and see The Kid Who Would Be King, because it is, it's just a really wonderful experience, and I look forward to what's next. Thanks.
Thank you.
From the score to The Kid Who Would Be King, that's Arthur's theme by the Electric Wave Bureau, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Joe Cornish. My huge thanks to Joe for taking the time to talk to us. The Kid Who Would Be King is on general release now, and I would implore you to get along to your local cinema with the family for good old-fashioned family entertainment. Now, we'll put a Spotify playlist up for this show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including the two featuring Edgar Wright. Please do, if you can, subscribe whilst you're there, or head to iTunes, where a rating would be, well, very much appreciated. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK for all the latest news. Next up sees the return of one of our favourite guests, Nicholas Britell, whose score for If Beale Street Could Talk is in with a great shout at the Oscars. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.